There are plenty of reasons oxytocin is referred to as the cuddle chemical. Levels of the hormone surge during caresses, and researchers think it evolved as a way to reduce stress and fear of others long enough to enable contact necessary for procreation. But for the first time, scientists have found that mom's innate ability to soothe and to boost oxytocin levels is as powerful whether she's offering a hug in person or consolation over the phone. A recent statement in Time magazine suggests that the human voice is even more powerful than we previously realized. Did language, or sheer vocalizations for that matter, develop as a means of reducing stress for the sake of bonding? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How can we measure the calming effects of language of a mother upon her offspring? Do we find the effect in species other than humans? Do we find a similar effect in the father-child bond? Our guest is Leslie Seltzer, a postdoctoral fellow in the Child Emotion Lab in the Psychology Department at the UW-Madison and lead author of the paper Social Vocalizations Can Release Oxytocin in Humans, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
Your study has gotten a lot of attention, hasn't it?
It has. In fact, we've been tracking citations. It's been quite a few. It's been a fun ride.
I suppose anytime you say something about how a mother's voice might affect children, you know, and the hormone levels, it's going to get people thinking, you know, what about those phone calls, you know, how that works. Can you take us back, though, to the sort of basics to begin with, starting with some idea about oxytocin itself and why you thought to study it?
Sure. Oxytocin is a hormone that all mammals produce, and its classic functions are thought to be related to lactation and birth, so those smooth muscle contractions that produce those effects. And in the last 20 years or so, people have started to realize that it has more effects than just those, more than just these physiological effects, but it also has effects within the central nervous system as well that can govern or regulate or mediate social behavior. And that's something that someone named Tom Insel found out in the 1990s, and he's the head of the National Institute of Health these days. And so it's been a very popular hormone to study because, again, it does seem to regulate how those bonds between individuals form and also how they're maybe maintained over time. So it's something that both males and females do produce, but it also shows some really neat sex differences in that males and females do differ in terms of how they release oxytocin. But it's been certainly best studied in the maternal-infant bond, so the relationships between moms and their kids.
And so where is this hormone produced? And give us, let's say, a typical mother who has a new baby. How is the hormone, how does it get released, and how is it effective?
Sure. There's two, some people would think more or less distinct processes. We, in our lab, think that they're more closely related. The way that it's produced outside of the brain, basically it's released from a portion of the brain called the posterior pituitary, gets into your bloodstream, and that's where those smooth muscle contractions that are responsible for labor and delivery, for example. Oxytocin is one of the few hormones where instead of a little bit kind of down-regulating, the more you have, the more you make, and that's why contractions get stronger and stronger as time goes on. And also in the bloodstream, it causes those smooth muscle contractions that expel milk as well. In the brain, there are a number of other connections within the brain that go to various other areas in the limbic system and elsewhere that basically those projections go off in a number of different directions. And it's not as well understood in humans how that works because we're not going to dissect human brains immediately after people socialize with each other.
The limbic system being the emotional center.
Yes, and in addition, other areas of the brain as well.
What about a woman who doesn't have children? How is oxytocin in her system? How is it expressed? How does it play into, say, a love relationship?
Sure. And oxytocin, again, is just best studied in moms and infants and their offspring. But it's by no means limited to those relationships. Some of the best-known non-maternal infant studies were done by Insel and his student Larry Young, where they looked at pair bonds and the formation of those monogamous relationships. Very few mammals are naturally monogamous. Maybe less than 2% of all mammalian species are. But there are these great animal models called prairie voles.
Right.
Yeah. Prairie voles are really neat because there's a closely related species called montane voles that behave really, really differently. And yet when you look at them, they're very similar animals. Prairie voles are monogamous. They mate for life. Montane voles are really promiscuous. And they diverged so recently, you'd think that there might be some interesting neurological differences that cause that speciation event. And so Insel and his student Young, and now, of course, many, many other people, have used the prairie vole and compared them to the montane vole in terms of where oxytocin receptors are in your brain. If you have a hormone, you need a receptor for it to fit into in order for a reaction to take place. And so if you look at the distribution of oxytocin receptors in the brains of prairie voles, they are much more abundant and dense than they are in these montane voles. So we might be talking about just one little change that caused this cascade effect in evolutionary terms that may have been responsible for that speciation.
Going which way, do you suppose? In other words, is the promiscuous vole a, quote, improvement over the bonded one or the other way around? And how do the two compare in terms of their survivability, assuming, you know, there's a difference?
Well, I don't know much about voles apart from their oxytocin systems, but I would imagine, given that monogamous relationships are less common, that probably the ancestor species was not a monogamous organism, although I can't be sure, and that the monogamous system perhaps evolved due to some genetic change that caused prairie voles to behave differently. But that's not to say that one is any better than the other by any means. They're
just
suited to different environments.
Well, if you try to figure out why in evolution would oxytocin have developed the way it would for humans, presumably it's to help mothers form an attachment to their child and stay with that child and nurture them. I mean, when you look at sort of what the advantage is from evolutionary point of view, what do you find?
Well, I mean, if you look at things other than mammals, right, mammals, of course, are famous for forming those really great relationships between moms and their young. They invest very heavily in each offspring, unlike something like a sunfish that's going to produce a zillion ova and there's going to be a zillion sperm.
Hardly knows their names.
Yeah, exactly. How can you memorize all those names? But it seems like the progenitor hormones that came before oxytocin in mammals weren't, of course, responsible for those relationships between moms and their young. And we're talking way, way, quite some time ago, hundreds of millions of years ago in evolutionary time. These hormones are older than mammals. They're older than reptiles. They're basically kind of things that came about with the evolution of social behavior in general in invertebrates. If you're a fish, you're not going to have copulation like you would expect in organisms that have reproductive systems like ours. We're just talking about organisms that are close enough to each other to release sperm and ova into the water, right? But you have to kind of overcome a little bit of stress in order to do that, because if you don't have that kind of a response to a larger individual who's coming pretty close to you, you might get eaten, right? And so this hormone, it's called oxytocin in fish and then vasocitocin in birds. They're very, very closely molecularly related hormones. Do seem to act to suppress that stress response for mating purposes.
In effect, you're trumping your survival instinct.
In many ways, but of course your survival is also highly dependent upon reproduction too, right? So you have to kind of balance the need to not get eaten with the need to make babies, right? And so that kind of system, that pair-bonded kind of system in mammals probably originates from those much older systems, and those relationships between moms and their young are probably outgrowths of social relationships in general. And then when mammals evolved and they started performing these functions like homeothermy and release of milk and all these nice things that we are famous for as mammals, then that's really when you start to see those maternal infant bonds become really, really important in mammals. Now, of course, other organisms like vertebrates and birds also do a lot of parenting too. And these similar hormones are involved there as well. But yeah, if I had to guess at a particular sequence of events, it would probably be just general social and sexual relationships that is where it started, and then the maternal-infant bond part came later.
Now, what's happening in the infant when the mother is releasing all this oxytocin?
there's almost nothing known about how babies are responding or how kids are responding. And this is why this study is kind of a new thing, because for the most part, people are looking at moms and how they react to their offspring. And nobody's really looking at it too closely in the opposite direction. But of course, the baby needs to bond with mom just as much as mom needs to bond with baby. But because mom is the responsible party for the baby and she's the one who really has to be in high gear in order for those maternal behaviors to kick in, it's been much better studied in adults. So, but this is an interesting study because it involves looking at it from the other direction. How do these kids form relationships with their parents?
I think there have been some studies here by Jenny Safran and others with the infant language where they're
yes.
even in utero aware of the sound of their mother's voice, even like a Spanish accent in their mother's voice. Can you tell us something about sort of vocalizations and the role that plays with the mother-infant bond?
Sure. Well, Jenny Safran is really, she does such interesting work. Her work is with figuring out when and how kids learn their own native languages. And it's just so neat. She studies something called statistical learning. And if you give someone a paragraph of various sounds, the baby's not going to understand what those sounds mean. But the one that she likes to use as an example is pretty baby, right? Just that kind of phrase.
Right.
And she'll say, well, prit as a sound comes before a lot of other sounds. Pretense, pretty. Pre is just a nice prefix, right? Whereas bay is a sound that comes before a lot of other sounds too. But T-bay, that kind of middle sound, is not very common. And so babies kind of learn where words stop and start by doing what she calls and others call statistical learning. So they can kind of figure out how likely it is that a sound either precedes or follows another sound. I mean, you and I can't do this. I mean,
no.
This is really mm-hmm. complex.
Yes.
This is something that, well, I mean, we can. But, of course, the first thing that strikes us whenever we hear an unfamiliar foreign language is, my gosh, I can't tell where one word starts and the other one stops. So that's what Jenny Safran does. Was that your question or was the...
Yeah, just sort of, well, I guess, about the relationship that sound vocalization plays in general with that mother-infant bond.
Well, again, it's something that, of course, you know, moms and infants talk to each other a whole lot, or infants babble at their moms and moms talk to their kids, and sometimes moms babble at their kids, too. However, the hormonal underpinnings of how that actually works is not something that's particularly well understood, but certainly that vocal communication between mom and infants, it's around a 20-something, late in the second trimester that infants are actually able to hear really anything that's going on outside the womb. And then by 31, 32 weeks, they're not just hearing vibrations, they're actually able to identify individuals' voices. And so it wouldn't be surprising, certainly, if there was something going on in utero that helped babies to understand who they were talking to or who was talking to them. But it's very hard to tell exactly how that facilitates the pair bond until those kids are a little bit older.
Well, I was wondering, after reading the Time magazine study where it talks about how a phone call from a mother can have a soothing effect, whether that mother's voice, there's still some residual memory from way back in utero where a certain sound is associated with the womb, with protection, familiarity.
I'm not really sure about what happens in the womb per se, but certainly by the time these kids are 7, 8 years old, there's a lot of history there as well about things that happened, you know, in the extrauterine environment as the kids were growing up.
So the bottom line seems to be that it's not just the physical contact, the cuddling,
right,
that releases the oxytocin. It's actually the sound, and not even necessarily that good a representation of the sound of the mother's voice.
Right. And that was what was really surprising to us with this study. When our results, one of my results came back from the lab, I was really surprised. I thought that, and everyone really thought, that physical contact, that contact between moms and their babies, the holding, the cuddling. Sue Carter calls it the love hormone, you know, like you want to, and it's supposedly dependent on tactile contact in humans and in other species as well. And this is the first time that anyone has showed, at least in these human kids, right, that there is another way of getting that exact same kind of response. Humans, of course, make and use language. You know, that's one of the hallmarks of our species. And so knowing that you can get the same response, or a really comparable response, from just hearing a voice, whether it's language per se in sensu stricto of recursive grammar, like is really unique to humans, or if it's just hearing the sound of someone's voice who you trust, and we're not currently able to tell which one it is or if it's both. But that is a really novel result, the fact that it's not just tactile contact. It's vocal contact, too.
Can you tell us something about the way that this study was set up?
Sure. Essentially, what we do is we have a public speaking paradigm. People hate public speaking. It makes them very nervous most of the time.
Hearing it or giving it?
Doing it. So what we do is we have a public speaking paradigm where we tell children that their job is going to be to complete a story that we're going to start for them. So we begin a story and we say that they're going to make up their own creative ending. And then they have some time to think about how they want to answer, and then they're going to go and meet the audience. And so then they go in front of the audience and they do a verbal portion and a counting portion as well. And it's not necessarily the difficulty level of the task. I mean, the tasks are fairly straightforward. It's doing it in front of an audience that seems to make, more often than not, people feel a little bit nervous. It's a mild nervousness that kids feel, but it's not a super pleasant thing to have to go through. And our audience members, they don't frown or criticize by any means. They're very neutral instead. And some people think that it's that ambiguity of feedback emotionally that makes people feel as if they're being evaluated, even if there is really no emotion being expressed on the person's face.
Writing between the lines.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you feel like you've made an error, for example, that can be something that, you know, can cause somebody to feel a little nervous, right? Especially when they're not getting that smile and nod and eyebrow lift like kids are used to getting when they are in a play or a spelling bee or something like that. And so that causes a hormone called cortisol, which is a stress hormone. At least most people think of it as a stress hormone, to increase. And what we were looking at was trying to see not just how oxytocin changed in these treatment groups. We had three of those: the kids who didn't get to interact with mom at all, the kids who interacted with mom over the phone, and that was for 15 minutes, and then the kids who interacted with their moms in person for 15 minutes. So we weren't just looking at the oxytocin differences. We were looking to see if mom's interaction with their children could bring down those levels of cortisol as well. And those kids who did have any type of interaction with their mom, whether vocal or physical, returned to their baseline levels of stress faster than the kids who just rested by themselves. And then essentially we collected saliva to measure the hormone cortisol by asking kids to spit into little tubes. Takes a little practice for the first one, but after that, kids fill them up like pros.
I'm
and
sure
we also
really into it.
Yeah, well, some of them really enjoyed it, and some of them thought it was really gross. And then for oxytocin assay, since at the time the salivary oxytocin assay was just being developed, but the urinary oxytocin assay was something that we felt pretty confident would work. And so we took a smaller number of urine samples than we did salivary cortisol samples. And then we just looked at the data, and then we did our hormonal analyses and looked at our data.
And we'll look more at the results of that study when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Leslie Seltzer. She is the lead author of a recent study about social vocalizations that release oxytocin in humans, and oxytocin is a hormone sometimes known as the cuddle drug or the love hormone that somehow makes mothers and apparently their offspring more calm and serene. And we've been talking about this experiment in public speaking, of all things, in which children, girls, I believe they were all girls.
In this study, yes.
Circa, 8 years old or so, were asked to do some public speaking, and then their stress levels were measured, and then the effect of the calming voice or presence or lack thereof of the mother. And what else did you find out about this other than the fact that their stress, surprise, surprise, goes up right before they're supposed to speak?
Well, again, as I was mentioning during the break, it's that anticipation period that we think is kind of getting them geared up. And then when they are in front of the audience, that's when they start to become, you know, that element of stage fright that many of us are familiar with, those butterflies that are in their stomach. Of course, kids who are feeling, I said, if you feel butterflies, that's okay and that's normal. If you start to feel pterodactyls in your stomach, go ahead and let us know you're ready to be done and we'll cut it a little bit short. We don't want anyone to feel too anxious while they're at our lab.
And how many girls did you bring in and how did you decide on the age group to study?
The girls were between the ages of 7 and 12, so they had to be at least 7, but under the age of 12. And the reason we chose girls in that age range was because, for the most part, kids that are younger than 7 might not have understood the task particularly well. And kids who were older might have been going through puberty, and that And, of course, we excluded those participants who had begun puberty a little bit earlier. For one thing, for assay purposes, to keep serum contamination out of our urine samples. But for another reason, because going through puberty really does create a lot of different hormonal changes. And, of course, we know that one of the most profound regulators of oxytocin is estrogen. And if we were dealing with cycling girls, girls who were a little bit older, we would have had to control for where they were in their cycle in order to be sure we were looking at data that were comparable.
Just got too complicated.
Mm-hmm. And why girls?
The literature about females and how females interact with one another was the primary reason. The oxytocin, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is something that is most studied, again, in the maternal-infant relationship. And much more is really known about how oxytocin works in females, given the influence of estrogen on how it works. And so that was our starting point. It was by no means our ending point in what we wanted to know. But we thought if this vocal communication thing is going to work, chances are good that we'll see it in females before we see it in males. So let's just start there. And of course, we subsequently ran a number of male subjects as well. So that's part of another study.
Okay. What about the effects of cuddling, some kind of reinforcement backstage before this assignment to do public speaking with another contestant? In other words, with a peer. Is there any kind of evidence that peer support helps?
Well, it's certainly been suggested. A book not recently at this point, came out called The Female Brain, where it was suggested, I'm probably pronouncing her name incorrectly. She's at Harvard. Luann Bizzardine, I think her name is. She really recently wrote another book about males and how they interact. But she did suggest that peer relationships might be more important, but that wasn't necessarily based on empirical studies. And in fact, she suggested that interacting with others, you know, should release oxytocin too.
If it's the right others.
If it's the right others, if it's a trusted other, someone that you know and that you know isn't going to, you know, behave negatively towards you, you should expect to see that increase. And so she suggested that based on theoretical work, and we thought, well, it might be a good idea to go ahead and test it and see if that's true. And it turns out she was right.
And how many girls did you bring in order to be sort of statistically valid?
There were 61 girls in this study, and it was more or less 20 per group with a little bit of difference in each group, just depending on, you know, various factors. But yeah, it was approximately 20 children in the control group where they got no interaction, 20 in the group where they were just talking, and 20 in the group where they were interacting individually with their moms, one-on-one in person.
And it said the ones that didn't interact with their mother were shown the movie March of the Penguins?
Actually, all the children watched the March of the Penguins movie.
Considered to be, what, emotionally neutral?
You know, some people think that it's really not emotionally neutral.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah.
There's the part where they lose the egg and it freezes, and then there's
it's
a part where
family.
The mom gets eaten by a leopard seal, and that's really like a sad part. But the kids actually don't get that far in the movie. They're basically just watching the introduction where all these nature documentary kind of things are going on. The penguins are moving from one place to another. So again, the kids in the control condition watch the first full hour of the movie. We're just shy, depending on if they watch the previews or not, right? It's really boring. And the girls who are in the other two conditions had those 15 minutes of interaction with their mom, and then subsequent to that did their resting period while watching 45 minutes of the film.
Okay, let's take the group that was interacting with their mothers in person. Mm-hmm. Then are you monitoring what's being said and how it's being said and whether there's touching going on or just sort of?
The families are instructed to behave in a way that's natural for their family, but to make sure that there is a hug involved, right? We monitored very closely in the beginning, but the actions between moms and their kids were pretty similar. And so ultimately, we kind of stopped monitoring and just made sure the hug was there and then let them have their normal interaction without us necessarily observing quite so much. Later on, we did an instant message condition to try and piece apart the language versus social vocalization thing. And it was remarkable how similar those communications were. You know, how was it? Oh, it was fine. Or, oh, it was hard. Or, oh, I'm hungry. And then, you know, what are we having for dinner? Like, it was all very, very similar. In any event, so the children didn't interact with their moms except during those periods where that was prescribed. And then they just basically watched the movie until the end. And it was, I think that resting period was really important while they were watching the film, because it's not just we're comparing per time point. We're looking at the rate of decrease of these hormones or the increase of these hormones.
And those 20 girls who had the mother physically there, their levels, stress levels, went down the most dramatically.
Right. By the sample immediately after they were done interacting, they were more or less back down to their baseline values. So certainly in terms of their cortisol response, again, this hormone that most people think of as a stress hormone, it looks like that caused the swiftest return back down to status quo, homeostasis, whatever you want to call it. The vocal communication condition had kind of an intermediate effect. And then the control condition where they didn't get to interact at all in terms of their stress levels, cortisol levels, was a much slower rate of decrease. And in fact, by the end of the hour, there were no statistical differences between either contact group, but both of those groups were lower, statistically speaking, than the ones that just rested by themselves, which still retained much higher levels of cortisol.
But the surprise for you, the researcher, was that that phone call had any difference at all.
Right. I mean, we weren't really sure what to expect because this isn't something that anyone has ever really looked at before. Again, from the perspective of looking at it from the child's neuroendocrinology, how their hormones are reacting, and also via this alternative to physical touch. Now, of course, the other thing is you ask questions about consistency and how parents reacted and how whether we were looking to see if they behaved positively or negatively. We administered some questionnaires. Of course, people do differ in how their relationship with their parent unfolds. And it was funny, our study was kind of spoofed on David Letterman when it first came out right after Mother's Day. And he said, I don't know who you guys are, but my relationship with my mom is not like that. Right? When I want to relax, I do not call her. And, you know, of course, he's
That's
a grown
a guy,
man.
Though.
Yeah, right. He's an adult male, right?
Although that would be true of some females, too. Certainly, there are a lot of cases of mother-daughter strife.
Right. So what we did was we administered a relationship quality questionnaire to try and get at some of those issues while the mom was waiting for her child to complete the task. We had her fill out a parent perspective questionnaire, and we had girls fill out a child perspective questionnaire about how their relationship went. And, of course, again, there are differences there. And we expected that to be much more relevant than we ultimately found that it was. I mean, the individuals we recruited were also control kids, too, right? These were not individuals we recruited from populations where children, for example, unfortunately had been abused in those kinds of populations. And so maybe it's less surprising than that. But we expected to find more variability than we did with respect to how those relationship quality questionnaires panned out.
And what were you hoping to kind of learn from it? What was the goal of this study?
With regard to the questionnaires or with regard
to
the whole thing?
No, the whole study. Is it to, in particular, you know, shed light on how to bring about closer relationship between mother and child, to understand how the hormones work, to are there sort of particular goals in mind with the study?
Yeah, the goal of my study was really I'm an evolutionary person. I'm a biological anthropologist. And so my interests in it were about the evolution of social systems and how those social systems work. The journal in which it was published is the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, which is a biology journal. And so often you'll hear things about lots of other organisms, comparisons between other organisms and how their relationships work. Really what I wanted to get at was a theoretical question that was proposed by Shelley Taylor in the earlier part of the last decade. And she suggested that males and females should regulate stress differently. Because if you're a male, you may only have a limited number of opportunities to mate. Males were by and large the far overrepresented in studies of the stress response. And so that's where we come up with ideology type or concepts like fight or flight, which is the classic stress response. But most of those individuals studied there were male, right? And of course, you might expect that if you happen to be male and you encounter someone who's larger than you and you're attempting to get mating access to a female, you might be better off running away. And if you're about the same size or bigger, you might want to engage in agonistic behavior, fighting behaviors to try and get access to females.
We played in bars all across the country every Saturday
night. Sure do. But even if those males lost those kinds of male-male competition, access to females kinds of interactions, it might still be ultimately worth it just to make that attempt because your mating opportunities might be more limited, and that's just based on the differences in the way in which males and females reproduce. Males only need to be there for a short period of time, right, in order for reproduction to take place. Females, on the other hand, it's not just that period of mating, it's not just that period of contest competition. what you're really looking at is an enormous investment if you happen to be a mammal, and a really enormous investment if you happen to be a primate, and a really, really enormous investment if you happen to be human, right, with this enormously protracted juvenile period in our species. So you would really, really want to avoid running away, which causes things to chase you, right, or engaging in agonistic interactions, fighting, because that's going to put you, if you're pregnant, you have a long gestation, right? You might lose your offspring that you've already invested so much energy in gestating. If you're caring for a newborn, that puts the newborn at risk. And, you know, if you're carrying an infant, that puts them at risk too, and it certainly puts you at risk. So it's a difference in the way in which males and females invest in their offspring that really causes the expected difference in how a female should respond to stress. And Shelley Taylor suggested that females, instead of fight or flight, should tend and befriend. So they should protect their offspring and themselves, and they should form social relationships, especially with other females, perhaps especially with female kin, such that when a threat presented itself, there would be more than one individual there who is on your side to help you out. And so those social relationships between females should be really, really important. And so she suggested that oxytocin might be involved. But again, there was almost nothing known in humans as to how that would work. And this is one of the first studies, again, showing that oxytocin does change in response to a stressful stimulus, and that it does increase when individuals interact or females interact with one another. And so that was really the reason that we tried to get at this, because Shelley Taylor had proposed something very testable, and we thought, here's a nice, easy way to see if that works or not.
So what would be the value of oxytocin for males, I mean, other than generally having their stress reduced? But if you're talking about, you know, a size differential, you know, suppressing your oxytocin release, well, that wouldn't be an issue for most males if it's a male-female encounter. How does it play out in males?
Well, it's not as if males don't have oxytocin. They certainly do. However, there's another hormone that males seem to use more for their affiliative and social behaviors called vasopressin. And it's interesting. It has an equally long evolutionary history. It has different effects outside the brain, perhaps as it does inside of the brain. And the hormone is called vasopressin in males.
Is vasopressin in females at all?
Yes. It controls things like water balance in your body when it's outside of your brain. And when it's inside of your brain, it controls various aspects of social behavior. And so it's been suggested these kind of like yin-yang hormones, you know, one is for males and one is for females. That's an oversimplification for sure. And that's not to say that oxytocin isn't important in the establishment of bonds either between males or between males and females or between males and their young. But vasopressin's role has certainly been better studied in males because of these differences in the ways in which other hormones, like steroid hormones, when I say steroid hormones, I mean things like estrogen, testosterone, right? These are steroid hormones, really seem to regulate the activity of these hormones.
So for contrast's sake, vasopressin does what in males when it's in the brain?
Well, I mean, it does many of the same things that oxytocin does in the brain. So regulates social behavior. Things like territoriality is very well studied, and things like birds, vasopressin in that case. Again, like, you know, there are different words depending on what vertebrate class you happen to be in. And vasopressin is the word that we use for what is essentially vasopressin's counterpart in birds. And so, things like territoriality, mating, various aspects of social aggression, those kinds of things that we tend to associate more with male behaviors. But again, that really is an oversimplification of everything that vasopressin and oxytocin do. And to say that one is for males and one is for females is a little too simple as well. But it does seem that there are sex differences that are relevant when you're comparing how those two hormones operate.
So do women have more oxytocin?
At any given moment, oxytocin may be the most abundant hormone in your bloodstream if you happen to be female. And of course, we have looked at males too. This is unpublished information, but it looks like males don't really release as much oxytocin as females do, at least in our urine samples.
Wouldn't be any advantage in it historically, would there? Males releasing oxytocin? I mean, a great quantity of oxytocin.
It depends on perhaps.
No need for labor, no need for lactation.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
I mean, a parent-child bond, or certainly a male-female bond, I mean, is it released during bonding with females and males, oxytocin?
It seems to be related to sexual behavior in both males and females. Orgasm is another thing that causes smooth muscle contractions in both males and females, and in the 80s, they did kind of an interesting study. I think this was Carmichael, maybe the 90s, where they had a little indwelling IV and they had people engage in sexual behavior. And checked out to see how their oxytocin levels
changed. I wonder how they got volunteers for that.
I'm not sure, but I'm sure they did it legitimately. And they did, in fact, show that sexual behavior released oxytocin in both males and females.
I would assume that lactation then would also release it in females.
It certainly increases it in the bloodstream. Yeah, absolutely. Birth, for sure. In fact, the brand name of oxytocin that they'll give to women who are having a slow labor and they want to speed things up is called Pitocin. Mm-hmm. Many women who have been induced, it's called induction of labor. Maybe you're going a little over your due date and your doctor's concerned that your baby might be a little too big. And so they'll administer Pitocin, which is just essentially, it is oxytocin, and that will cause you to go into labor.
So let me ask a strange question.
Uh-oh, okay.
Given the social ramifications of oxytocin, are there ways that are artificial of obtaining it or somehow stimulating it?
Well, that's another really great question. I really like that question because there are so many studies coming out right now where they do exactly that. They want to see how oxytocin works. Our study was what's called an endogenous study. So we're looking to see what the body is just doing naturally as we apply different stimuli to individuals. The opposite way of looking at what oxytocin might do is to administer oxytocin like a drug and then see how their behavior changes, right? And the way that people like to do that is via intranasal oxytocin. So they squirt it right up your nose, and that ideally would cross the blood-brain barrier and potentially alter the way that you behaved.
And the way you, say, respond to that mm-hmm. other person.
Right. And there are studies where they look at adult relationships and how that might affect those. My favorite, though, probably were from a couple of years ago where they looked at investment partners. And
literally talking about money here?
Cash money, yes. Uh-huh. What they did was that there are some really fun studies in economics where they deal with actual cash, sometimes very large quantities of actual cash. I'd love to see those grant applications. We need $10 million to do this study. Okay.
Well, we'll give some of it back.
Maybe. If you're lucky. But what they did was they had investment games, an economic game, where they paired people up. And those individuals who had been given oxytocin, intranasal oxytocin, as opposed to a placebo, trusted their partners with more money.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so they definitely look at how it might be relevant in real-world situations, not just in terms of relationships between mates or between moms and infants, but
trust of all kinds.
Trust of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And of course, trust is something that people think is facilitated by a stressful experience. If you and I, you know, go through some sort of shared trauma or trouble mm-hmm. together, that
shoot
may
the
forge
rapids
a,
or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. May form a bond between us, and certainly kind of struggling through, like, should I trust this individual? Should I not? And if they turn out to be trustworthy, then that might very well forge a bond between individuals.
I'm kind of seeing not in the too far distant future where it's available in some form as a nasal spray and you kind of like, you know, give a quick squirt somehow to that person whose trust you want for whatever reason and kind of short circuits the whole trust process.
I remember, yeah, exactly. I remember reading something about how advertising does exactly that. Without us really knowing about
it. Squirt up the nose?
Yeah, we'll see an image that's emotionally relevant to us and advertise. And this commentary came out after that investment partner study was published. Well, yeah, you know. And then, of course, there was that ethical concern. You know, if we do go ahead and somehow manufacture at a conference, someone said, are we going to give this to wives before their husbands go away on business trips? I mean, is that ethical? Is that something we're comfortable with? And the response was, well, advertising companies make it their business to know how to do that. How to get these kinds of emotional responses so that you trust their product, for
example. We're saying this is just one
step
past that.
We're already doing it, yeah. Exactly.
But are there dangers to oxytocin if it gets too high a level?
Well, that's another interesting question. At this point, we've run hundreds and hundreds of samples of oxytocin for many, many participants. And there are some individuals who release very large amounts of oxytocin in their urine. And, of course, we're not entirely certain how that relates back to what's going on in the brain. But I've never noticed any real correlation between people who release larger amounts of oxytocin and, you know, people who have some sort of physiological or health concern. So we're not – I don't think that there's necessarily – we don't know of anything necessarily that could make it just too much.
We'll look further at the chemistry of trust when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Leslie Seltzer. We're talking about oxytocin and other ways that hormonal levels are affected when mothers and children interact. And the interesting studies that were done showing that girls responded to the sound of their mother's voice over the phone or the presence of their mother after being in a stressful situation. Some of the studies that you were talking about, and these have been done with humans, remind me of the early work done at UW-Madison in the Primate Center where monkeys would, if I remember right, they would cuddle with wire mothers rather than not at all. I mean, this search for some kind of affection, some kind of bond is pretty poignant.
Right. In fact, that's our history in terms of our lab and our relationship with the Primate Center and learning about how these processes that we know take place in primates might be translational when we look at humans and how they mature and develop. And the experiments of Harry Harlow and his students just exemplify the problems that can come up when individuals don't get the kind of rearing that is typical for their species. And the wire versus the cloth mother is the classic example. Those infants were both fed, they were both given food, but the ones that were on the wire mother developed all kinds of difficulties that the ones that were reared on the cloth mother didn't.
I would prefer cloth, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And we're kind of starting to see those differences show up in humans, too, who are reared in what might be considered to be species atypical environments. One of the things that the Child Emotion Research Lab looks at is institutionalized children who are reared in orphanages for protracted periods of time. They don't get that kind of interaction with people that kids who are reared by their biological parents do. They don't get hugged. They don't get talked to either. They don't get played with. And not surprisingly, sometimes those children do show differences in the way in which they mature and develop. And that was a study that came out in our lab as well. Allison Wismer-Fries was the PhD student there, also one of the PhD students of Seth Pollock, as I was. And she looked at kids who had been adopted and institutionalized for a certain period of time and compared them with control populations of kids who had been reared at home by their biological families. And what she found was that when the children who were the biological offspring interacted with their biological parent, they showed an increase in oxytocin. And when they interacted in a physical way with a stranger, they played like a patty cake game, they didn't show an increase in oxytocin. The kids who were institutionalized didn't show an oxytocin response to either group. And so they were not showing the hormonal backbone of what we think of as being a social bond between children and their parents.
So that would be like an attachment disorder kind of thing then, right, if you can't form that bond?
Well, it's not saying that those children don't have any bonds whatsoever with their adoptive parents, but it may indicate that there is some kind of dysregulation that takes place because one of those early environments, like being in an orphanage, it switched on some portion of your brain or switched off some portion of your brain that makes you interested in or capable of or as capable of forming those attachments a little bit later on. We don't like to make such a strong statement that these children can't form attachments because certainly it depends on how long a child was institutionalized and the conditions of those institutions too. But it was for both oxytocin and vasopressin that these kids just didn't show any type of peptide response. The hormones are peptide hormones.
It does raise an interesting question about the difference between biological and adoptive parents, though. And I mean, I suppose it would be a factor of how early that child was adopted as to how reactive she would be in this case to an adoptive mother.
Well, again, I'm not an adoption expert by any means, but certainly something that's been known for a while is that it does depend on how long an individual was institutionalized and the type of care that they get. I mean, there are wonderful places where kids can be reared, where they have people who care for them, and the child forms a good, strong attachment to them. Unfortunately, there are places where that's not true as well. But as for the specifics, I'm not really an expert, and so I hesitate to comment.
Your study looked at girls and mothers. I'm sure you've probably been asked a lot, you know, why leave out fathers? Why make them feel even less a part of the equation because they don't have the oxytocin? But are there other labs or other studies that are going to be looking at the father-child bond or the mother-son bond in a similar way?
We have run all of those permutations, the mother-son, the father-son, the father-daughter, mother-daughter. We simply chose to publish our study involving moms and girls first. We thought that was such an important result to get out. It was the first time we were showing that vocalizations release oxytocin in humans of any stripe. And we went ahead and published it with this dyad, the mother-daughter dyad, first. And later on, we will certainly be publishing our work with boys and how they may differ. But those are unpublished data so far. So
top secret.
Highly top secret right
Can't
now.
Can't wait for that report to come out.
Not much longer now.
So are you going to do things like try the effect of text messages on reduced stress levels?
That study is currently complete and under analysis.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
It almost seems as if your study could be used to advertise phone calls. You know how they
reach out and touch someone
because it can help their stress level go down and the good hormones get released.
I think that's the first thing that Dr. Pollack said when I told him what my results were.
The phone call.
Reaching out and touching someone. I wonder if that might have something to
– Sounds like some grand potential there.
Right.
So what do you do with this now that you have it, this information in particular that a phone call also reduces stress level in a child?
Right. The kids in the group where they interacted in person and the kids in the group where they interacted over the phone showed almost indistinguishable oxytocin levels. And that was true even an hour later.
Save mom a trip?
Potentially, or it may be something that's important for moms who need to travel and they're not always able to physically be there, but they want to keep that bond going. And, you know, especially if your child's had a bad day and you really want to be there for them, but you can't be there for them. And there are a lot of other directions in which this could go. I'm certain that people who go through other types of relationships and depending on what kinds of vocal communication they engage in would have a different social response. For example, things like tone are so important in terms of meaning in language. I mean, I could say something like, wow, that's a really great idea. And that means the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. Even though those are grammatically identical statements, the tone in which it's being said negates the meaning of what's being said. And so one of the things that we're looking at is how things are said, tonality versus the grammatical content of utterances, because those things are just so important. How many times do people tell us it's not what you say, it's how you say it?
Especially if you're a dog.
That's another study that someone actually proposed that we do, looking at non-humans and looking at how vocal communication between either pet owners and their animals or between individuals of the same species. For example, at the Primate Center, we have another species that's socially monogamous, is the common marmoset. And they form male-female bonds, and they have little families. And, you know, it certainly is true that stress responses are different in those types of species, the calotrichids, the New World monkeys. And so if they hear their mate making a vocalization, that decreases their stress if they're isolated. But if they hear a large male that's unfamiliar vocalizing, then they may not have a decrease in stress, quite the contrary. And so I imagine it's very important who is talking, who is listening, what's being said, and how it's being said in the tonality of those elements. And so that's kind of the future of what we're going to be looking at with respect to social bonding as facilitated by communication in humans and other organisms.
If you were going to extrapolate from all the work that you've been doing in the lab, the paper and the papers that are coming out and so on, would you say that there's sort of a take-home message for parents, for those of us who have children of any age?
Well, hopefully this provides parents with a little bit of comfort, knowing that there's an alternative to physical contact when you can't be there in person. It may actually be just as effective, at least in terms of stress reduction and the release of this hormone oxytocin, to talk to your child over the phone. We certainly use lots of other types of technology to communicate with people. Some of them are really, really popular. The phone, of course, is now, I think, even kind of becoming less popular as people use other types of media to communicate.
Skype in particular, we have the visual as well
exactly.
as the audio.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we wonder if that visual element might not come into play as well as the vocal element. Or, you know, of course, people communicate. I really don't use the phone to communicate that often with anyone other than my own mother. I don't like long phone conversations. But certainly, I do a lot of text messaging, and I do a lot of instant messaging. And so it's a really, really interesting future study to kind of look at how those other types of media can influence our brains and our behavior. humans, again, are the only animals that make and use language. We have this unique capacity to communicate what's going on in our heads with others. In fact, it's always amused me that people say, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could read minds? I'm like, you don't have to. You can just tell someone what you're thinking.
Imagine that.
We have a way of doing that now. We've had it for millions of years, right? And so I think it's really important to piece out those elements that are grammatical from those elements that are, we call it prosodic, the tonal cues of language. And certainly I think it's important to look at how different types of media are influencing our social behavior as we move forward into the future.
All those students I see on their cell phones not talking to each other or anyone around them.
I think it's rare these days for a phone conversation to be what even I remember from my childhood. I'm not very old, but I remember we would speak on the phone and that was the only way to really communicate with anyone. Now, messages are so much shorter, right? I might say like 10Q as opposed to thanks even, right? As a text message or be there in a few. People like to choose how and when they go about their social lives, and I think it's becoming more and more minimalistic, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is for the cultural anthropologists to evaluate.
We'll see how it plays into oxytocin levels and all of that release of the cuddle drug in the new technologies. Our guest has been Leslie Seltzer. Boy, fascinating tour of the latest developments, some of them having to do with stress and trust and the way humans interact. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a good time.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, historian Stanley Payne will take us back to the Middle Ages in Spain, a time when Christians and Moors were in a state of constant combat. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.